Hello everybody, welcome to the first of hopefully many Harvington Hall podcasts. My name is Phil. I am currently the Hall and Programmes Manager at Harvington, but I've actually been a tour guide at Harvington for 4 years now, and I will admit this straight off the bat to everyone, I am obsessed. It is my life. It has been my life for many years, actually. It's a house I've visited for quite a while now, and it's something that just grabs you, and you can't explain it, and I'm sure all the volunteers, our wonderful volunteers and visitors, will back me up when I say it just has this atmosphere about it that you can't put your finger on, you can't explain it, it just grabs you, you know. And when you walk into the house, you are looking at such an original Elizabethan house. You know, little restoration work or building work has really taken place since around 1600. So it has just that authenticity about it that, you know, that's just so unique. But last year in 2019, Harvington finally won the UK Heritage Award for Hidden Gem. Long overdue, in my opinion. It's an award we should have won probably years ago. We already knew it as a hidden gem, but finally, we've got the recognition that we deserve. So I hope you enjoy this podcast. We've got a lot coming up today. We have a special guest, which I'll get to very shortly, which I'm really, really excited about. But why are we doing this podcast in the first place? Well, the first thing is, I don't know if you can just hear actually the Harvington Church bells going as I'm doing this, so I'm trying to block that out of my mind. But why are we doing the podcast? Well, if you look outside, like it is the day I'm recording this, it's a sunny, warm day, and this is during the coronavirus lockdown. The weather is abnormally good. What is going on? I don't know what's going on, but the weather has just been really nice, and of course, this time of year is the time of year we would be going in our thousands to historic houses all across the country and enjoying the nice weather. But unfortunately, we can't do that. So we're bringing the hall to you by doing this podcast. But if you follow us on Facebook and Instagram, we are also posting a lot of photos and video content as well to keep you guys entertained and engaged during the lockdown period. But the other thing is, last year, we also had a survey of the site, and it pointed out that the barrel vaulted ceiling in our withdrawing room needs, shall we say, just a little bit of TLC. And we took the decision last year, a tough decision, to actually close the hall to get the building works done. And we thought, actually, what a great time to get the whole site surveyed and get all the work done in one hit. There's nothing more frustrating than closing the hall for a couple of years than having to, you know, do some building work and then close it again a few years later. You know, let's just get it all done in one go. And that's actually quite exciting because we can speak with contractors while they're on site, and you never know, fingers crossed, they might find something else out that we didn't already know. So by doing the podcast, we get to speak to contractors, you'll be in the thick of it and you'll know what's going on pretty much as it happens, which is, I think, really, really exciting. Anyway, today we have a special guest, and I am really excited about this. It is one of my favourite historians. Her name is Jessie Childs. Now, Jessie is an award-winning author. She also features regularly on TV, on television documentaries. And most recently, the hall was on Lucy Worsley's Biggest Royal History Fibs. We're on episode one. It was to do with the Reformation and Henry's break with Rome. But it also went a little bit further than that and started talking about the religious changes and what it was like for Catholics during the reigns of Elizabeth I. Now, Jessie was on that programme discussing that with Lucy. And this is why I've asked Jessie to be on this podcast, because her book, which is, well, one of her books, which is my favourite book, it's called God's Traitors, Terror and Faith in Elizabethan England. I think it's just got such a good punchy title, hasn't it? It's a title that really makes you want to read the book. And Jessie's book doesn't talk about Harvington Hall as such, but it tells you about the Catholic experience during the reign of Elizabeth I. And that is basically what Harvington is all about. Harvington Hall, from the outside today, if you see it, it's a stunning, absolutely beautiful Elizabethan house built in the 1580s that sits and is surrounded by a 13th century moat. Now, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of the history of the hall. I'll do that on more, you know, on future podcasts. But the hall that we see today was built by a Catholic man called Humphrey Packington. He was also what they called a known recusant. Now, a recusant is a term that you've probably never heard before, but I will let Jesse explain that in a moment. Now, as these podcasts progress, of course, we will be looking at the history of Harvington a little bit more in depth. The origins of Harvington go back into the 1200s. So we're starting this story really in the hall that we know of, that we see today, of the 1580s. So without further ado, if you like to get yourself a cup of tea or whatever your favourite tipple may be, depending on the time of the day, then please sit back and enjoy the next 30 or 40 minutes or so with Jesse. So hello, Jesse. Thank you so much for being our first guest on the Harvington Hall podcast. How are you? Are you okay?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a great honour to be your first.
No, not a problem. No, thank you very much. It's an honour to have you on. So, Jesse, for those of you that don't know who you are, could you just introduce yourself and give us an insight into who you are?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm Jesse Childs. I guess I'm an early modern historian. I started off with the Tudors. My first book was about the Earl of Surrey, who was first cousin to Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, and he was right there in the thick of Henry VIII's court, and he was the last guy executed by Henry VIII. So I loved writing about him. He was a poet, and he was a courtier, and a soldier, and he was very reckless, and he sort of wore his heart on his sleeve. So I thought it was quite a good way of looking at Henry VIII's reign, you know, with a new angle, with a new lens. And then my second book was God's Traitors, which I guess we're going to be talking about. And right now I've gone into the English Civil War, the British Civil Wars, or the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, which people call it now, which is kind of Game of Thronesy and cool. It's so interesting and important. And actually, it sort of carries on the theme of anti-popery, anti-Catholicism, that we'll probably talk about. So yeah. Yes, I suppose I'm an early modern historian, and I write books that hopefully you will find in places like Waterstones, and that I try and make history accessible, but without simplifying it too much, you know, so sort of scholarly-ish, hopefully well-researched, non-fiction.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can see that, especially from God's Traitors, which I have already mentioned, but this is my favourite history book, without a doubt. So to speak to you actually is a real honour anyway, in itself. So God's Traitors, Terror and Faith in Elizabethan England. Can you just give us an insight into what that book is actually about?
Yes, it is about the Catholic experience of the reign of Elizabeth I. So when I was at school, and when I was growing up, the sort of image of Elizabeth I was good Queen Bess. It was Gloriana and all that. And I then started reading the literature of the time, the poets, and sort of finding out more. I remember reading Antonia Fraser's Gunpowder Plot book, and thinking, wow, this is whole experience of Elizabethan England that I didn't know about. So what I wanted to do was sort of, I guess, give the underbelly of Elizabeth's reign a little bit. And it's not black and white. I mean, it's such a sort of grey area, whether you're a persecuted Catholic or a loyal Catholic, or whether you can even be a Catholic in Elizabeth's reign. So it was trying to convey that experience, and talking about the priest holes and the torture and the terror, some really grisly stuff, but also trying to convey it in a way that people can sort of grasp. So I told the story through a family. A family not far from Harvington, actually, in Northamptonshire, Harrod and Hall. And they were called the Vaux family. And they start off, the patriarch, Lord Vaux, starts off as a sort of loyal Elizabethan. And then what you see as the reign progresses and events sort of spiral, you see the next generation becoming slightly radicalized, and fighting up for their faith and wanting to preserve their faith, and going to quite extreme methods to try and do that. So that's what the book's about. It's a sort of family saga. It's a family story, but it's their experience of persecution in Elizabeth's reign.
Excellent. And I mean, one character in particular that sticks out from my mind in that book is Anne Vaux. She just sounds like a formidable lady that you wouldn't cross, I don't think.
She's sort of, she's almost like a sort of foil to Elizabeth I. You know, Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen. But Anne Vaux's nickname was also the Virgin. That was her code name. And she never married. And she basically dedicated her life to preserving Catholic priests, to keeping them alive in England at this time. Catholic priests were not allowed in England. From 1585, there was a law passed that stated that any priest who'd been ordained abroad and who even set foot on English soil would automatically be deemed a traitor, and he would be hand-drawn and executed if he was caught. So Anne and her sister Eleanor, they were known together as the Widow and the Virgin. You can't understand why people write novels about this, yeah. Right? But they ran this network of safe houses, largely in the Midlands, and they would host various priests who would sort of ride up, and they had the superior of the Jesuit mission, that basically means the head of the Jesuit mission, Henry Garnet, was in that house. So you would get lots of priests coming to stay, coming to consult him. And so they would keep them safe. And one of the people in their household was a carpenter called Nicholas Owen, Little John. He was from Oxford. And he built priest holes inside these houses. They were usually big Elizabethan manor houses. And he was incredibly talented. And he would build these wonderful little priest holes, which would hide the priests, so that when there were raids, and there were raids on these homes, there were a lot of spies about, then these priests would hide in these priest holes and hopefully get away with it and carry on, you know, singing the mass and giving the sacraments to Catholics who desperately needed them.
Excellent. So on that, I mean, you're saying that for anyone who's listening and hasn't ever heard of Harvington Hall as well, because there will be people listening, you mentioned Little John there, Nicholas Owen. Harvington Hall has a series, we believe, of Nicholas Owen priesthoods, of course. Nicholas Owen... as you'll know, wouldn't really put his name to many priesthoods because, of course, he's going to be England's most wanted man. But we have two saints attributed to Harvington Hall, and one of them is Nicholas Owen because he was canonised by the Pope. So he is Saint Nicholas Owen. So it's great to sort of, you know, hear his sort of side of it and what he was doing at that time. It's remarkable, really.
He was a really interesting guy. Again, like Anne Vaux, he couldn't be a priest. He wasn't a priest. He was a lay brother. But it was very much his vocation, this mission, and he dedicated his life to it, and he put himself at great risk. And he couldn't have blueprints, he couldn't have maps about, he couldn't work the way carpenters normally would. He had to be sort of keep it in his head, really, and he had to keep changing his MO so that people wouldn't recognise an Owen Hyde. Yeah. So you see them everywhere. Harvington has got, I think you've probably got the best set in the country, don't you? I mean, it's the most wonderful place. Everyone must go to Harvington Hall. and I think every school child, you know, there should be a school trip there as well. Apart from anything else, it's great fun if you're a kid, isn't it? Hide and seek.
I mean,
it's, didn't you do a day in a priest hall, a day and a night?
Yes. 24 hours in actually a Nicholas Owen priest hide as well. So under the stairs.
Oh my God.
So I was there.
How big was that one? Did you stand up?
So it's 5'9" in length. I'm 6 foot tall. So it's 5'9" in length, 5 foot across, and it's 6 foot high, which is a bit higher than it originally used to be, because now you sort of hit the floorboards above you, but there would have been another sort of ceiling underneath that. So if they ripped the floorboards up, they wouldn't see directly into the hide.
Oh my God.
But it's just very cramped. And I had another priest in there with me. I had, I'm not a priest, but I had a mannequin in there, Brother Leo, we call him.
So that's Brother so Leo creepy.
Is sort of sitting there, you know, praying in there. But as you all know as well, and I'm sure we're going to talk about Hinlip in a moment. I mean, you know, Hinlip being down the road from Harvington, but there were two priests in the hide together. Yeah. That's quite a common thing. If there's two, you know, if there's two priests there, they're going to be in there together. So,
yes. You know, and also, all the vestments and the massing equipment and the candlesticks, anything, rosaries, anything that would give away your faith, they would sort of cram them into priest polls as well. And it was a case of how much time you had. You might have to go into one of those ones. There was, yes, with Nicholas Owen, he only had an apple to share, didn't he?
Yeah.
Were you allowed food?
Yes. And do you know what? This is really frustrating me actually, because since going in doing that, I've read Father John Gerard's autobiography since then.
Yeah.
And I saw in that they had red wine already in the hide. He mentioned when he was at, what was it called again now? Can't remember. Braddock's, that was it.
Yes.
Some red wine in one of the hides. And I didn't take red wine in with me. So I had an apple, a bottle of water, and a piss pot. I literally did it as genuine as I could. I had no watch, no torch, no mobile phone. It was a case of lights off. There you are, 24 hours in costume with a blanket, and just, try and get
That's
through
so
it.
That's so interesting. What was your, sorry, I'm now asking you all the questions, but I'm so interested. What was your sense of time then? So did it feel like you'd been going for hours when you'd only done a few minutes?
Yeah, and strange enough, it's actually on YouTube that people can watch. I had a night vision camera in there with me. And you'll see me sort of during the night waking up and talking to the camera and saying, oh, it's got to be early hours of the morning. And actually, it was only 11 o'clock at night when I thought it was, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. So totally confusing. The hall manager at the time of Harvington, a lady called Emma, had to sleep outside of the hide for health and safety reasons. We weren't allowed to talk to each other. We weren't talking or anything like that. But it totally throws you. You don't know what time of day it is. The only way you know is when the ducks are quacking, because you can hear the ducks and you think it's got to be the morning time.
Yeah.
And then the thing is, so I was supposed to go in at 5 p.m. And so all the media, the local media knew I was going in at 5 p.m. But I didn't actually go until 6:30 p.m. So come 5 o'clock the following day, when I should be coming out of the hide, the parish priest from over the road, Father John Moran, came to the hall and I could hear him talking to the manager saying, is he out yet? So I knew it was 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
So that last hour and a half was the longest hour and a half of my life, I can assure you.
But in a way, that's quite authentic too, that you could hear voices and they're discussing you. And I think that's a really cool thing to have done. And you read accounts that there are some priests, there was one called Thomas Lister who was claustrophobic. And you kind of think, what a hellish ordeal that must have been for him. And then there was another one who lived with Garnet and the sisters at times, and he was called Thomas Stanny. And he ended up losing it altogether. And he had all these dreams about the village being at war. And I think in the end, he sort of ran out and stabbed a man. But you can kind of understand, it must be so discombobulating. Plus, as extraordinary as your ordeal must have been, you know that you're going to come out and you're going to have a meal and you can have a bath and you're not going to get tortured when you come out. I mean, it must have been really terrifying.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. And even though I had a mannequin in there with me, you do have, it does feel like company. It's quite a strange, it's so difficult to explain to people that this mannequin's obviously not talking to me, he's just in there praying, but just that feeling of being together. And I mean, I'm not religious, but you do get a sense of, I can never understand what it must have been like, but you do get that feeling of, but how dedicated the priests were. I can't get my head around just the devotion. It's incredible.
I think, I'm the same as you. I'm not religious, but it's reading John Gerard's autobiography, which you mentioned, which is, God, it's one of the most thrilling sources of this period. Yeah. I mean, incredibly biased, and you have to take a lot of what he says with a pinch of salt. But in terms of getting people into this period of history, I wouldn't recommend a book more highly than that. I mean, it's just so exciting. It's a thriller. But he was writing about being in probably Braddock's and saying how, yes, his strength of faith and feeling that Jesus was with him. And I think for them, they sort of, especially the Jesuits, they had quite intense training.
Yeah.
A lot of it was very meditative. Something called spiritual exercises. And so they would sort of go into these meditations and sort of walk with Christ and almost feel like they were having their own, the passion of Christ and suffering with Christ. And I think for them, that was hugely powerful and gave them the strength to endure.
Yeah. I mean, something that strikes me when I'm doing tours of Harvington that, as you mentioned earlier on, that this sort of subject isn't really spoken about very often. It's not something that you regularly see, that this sort of persecution of Catholics during the reign of Elizabeth. And something that people always say to me at Harvington, well, of course, this is all because of Henry VIII, isn't it? Which just shows that sometimes to me, you just assume people know things, but obviously in between Henry and Elizabeth, there was a lot of yo-yoing with religion as well. So although he broke with Rome, it's actually more to do with Elizabeth's reign, with why the priest hides have come about and, you know, and that
Absolutely.
Kind of thing. So, I mean, could you just explain a little bit about that? I mean, for people that don't understand.
Sure. I mean, that's, again, sort of with the book, that's why I did a family, because I think it sort of explains it better. So if you look at the head of the family, Lord Vaux, he was born in the reign of Henry VIII, in the same year, actually, that Thomas More was executed for resisting the divorce, well, for resisting the royal supremacy. For Thomas More, the Pope was the head of the church, the spiritual head, and he couldn't accept that Henry VIII was the head of the church. But then Henry VIII himself was, you know, he was not quite, you know, not quite Catholic. He was thinking about Lutheran theology, but he always revered the Mass. And he always believed that the real presence of Christ was in the Mass. And this is one of the key Catholic beliefs. It's one of the reasons why they needed the priests in Elizabeth's reign, because they need the Mass, they need this spiritual food. But then after Henry VIII dies, then you have the reign of his son, Edward VI, the boy king, who is far more Protestant than Henry VIII ever was. And that's when you get a real swing. You talk about the yo-yo, that's a, you know, real swing to Protestantism. But then he didn't last very long. And then you get Mary, his half-sister, who is strongly Catholic and returns the Pope to the primacy of the church, famously burns around 300 Protestants at the stake for not being Catholic, effectively. And then you get, a few years later, you get Elizabeth. So for Lord Vaux, who is a very devoted Catholic, yes, exactly, you're right. We have this swinging, this yo-yoing. So at the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, I think a lot of Catholics just thought, well, let's see it out. You know, this is just going to be one more swing of the pendulum. And soon we can be Catholic again and we can worship freely again. And what happens with Elizabeth's reign, as we all know, but they didn't, is that she reigns for 44 odd years. And with that time, you have people being christened in this new Protestant church, Church of England, and people not being brought up Catholic. And so it becomes easier with time for people to sort of associate Protestantism with the national faith. But certainly earlier, that wasn't the case at all. And so this is why there is this sort of fight in these Catholics, that they think, you know, let's just see this out.
Yeah. So can you just explain to people as well, because Harvington Hall is known for probably, I mean, obviously known for having seven priest hides, the most that there are surviving in any house in England. But also the family of the house were recusants. So I was just wondering if you could sort of give our listeners an understanding, what is a recusant?
Sure. It's, again, it goes back to what you were saying about when you're touring and you sort of assume that people know these words, but actually recusant is such a weird word and not that many people have heard of it. It comes from the Latin recusare, and it simply means to refuse. So a recusant is a refuser. And it's basically someone who refuses to go to Protestant church services every Sunday. And according to the law, if you refuse, then you would be fined. And at the beginning of the reign, it was a token sum. It was hardly anything. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, but in 1570, Elizabeth I is excommunicated by the Pope. And then in 1580, you get the Jesuit mission and things start ramping up. So in that year, 1580, the fines go up massively to £20 a month. So if you're a recusant, you're one of these people who are willing to pay every month for your faith to not go to Protestant church services. So they're kind of, I suppose, shorthand, you'd say they're the more hardline Catholics.
Yeah.
What you get sort of from about 1580 onwards is people who are known as church papists. They'll go to church, and so they will avoid the fine and they will avoid persecution of any kind. But they might be Catholic secretly at home. They might think, well, I'll take the last rites on my deathbed. Or they sort of, you get people sort of making all these little fudges, you know, just the equivalent of crossing your fingers behind your back sort of thing. There was a guy called Richard Shireburn in York who would put cotton wool in his ears every time he went to church. So there's sort of some people who would register these mini protests, and then you have the recusants who register slightly more vocal and more prominent protests.
Yeah, I think I'll admit this to you now, the church papers. So when I start my tour off at Harvington, I always mentioned recusancy and that the family were recusants and what have you, but I always mentioned the church papists, and I've actually taken that from your book about the guy plugging his ears with wool and the one lady when receiving the bread actually spitting it out and treading on it, and I've read that in your book, and the amount of people that laugh at that. But then in your book you also mentioned about, you know, there is one guy that actually did try to commit suicide after attending a Church of England service. So as much as it sort of makes you smile, it just shows you that how serious they took it. I mean, I think that's one thing that you really get a sense of.
That's so true. And yes, people who would keep their hats on, which again, you sort of think, well, that's just slightly bloody minded. But actually, for them, it's really a way of saying, I'm not going to bow down to this authority. Mm. And yes, I, it's one of the hardest things to convey now in an age that is majority sort of secular, to try and get yourself back into their shoes and convey quite how important faith was back then for them. Mm-hmm. You know, the afterlife is so important, and what everyone's trying to do is find a pathway to heaven. You know, they all believe in heaven. You have a few atheists popping up now, but most people believe in God and they believe in heaven, and they believe in salvation. So it's so important to find the right path. And if you're a monarch, and this is why, you know, Mary the First was so hardline, for her, she very much believed that it was part of her duty as a queen to save souls. So she wouldn't have seen it as sort of burning people at the stake. She would have seen it as sort of purifying their souls and saving the rest of the country. And with Elizabeth as well, she was never as hardline as Mary. And she, I do believe, you know, she said she didn't want to force people's consciences. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's true. When she was in Mary's reign, when she was told to go to Mass, she went to Mass, which is quite a big difference. And then we're going back and yo-yo again. But back in Mary's reign, when Edward the Sixth, her brother, made her go to Protestant communion, she refused. So there's the difference between the two sisters. Elizabeth will compromise.
Yeah.
But what she expects when she's queen is obedience. And I think her duty as a queen, you know, the religious side of it, she did take seriously.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we always have to remember as well what's going on in Europe. This is a time of holy war, effectively.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, the 1580s for me, I mean, it's strange. Harvington was built in the 1580s, and that's probably the worst decade in my eyes, I don't know about you, but for Catholics, because like you say, you've got the Jesuits arriving, we're now at war with Spain. It's, you know, traitor, to set foot on English shore, you're a traitor. You know, the Babington plot, the Throckmorton plot, you've got the, you know, the Armada. It's all happening within that decade.
Yes, yes. It's crunch time, really, isn't it? It's, I think, sort of the first few decades of Elizabeth's reign, people aren't quite sure what's going to happen, whether she'll last long. I mean, actually, I can't remember who wrote an article about this. So interesting. Basically saying the word Protestant wasn't used in Elizabethan England until at least the 1580s. You know, people would call themselves Catholics still, or Christians. So it is, I think the 1580s is this sort of great sort of middle decade where people have to decide, you know, which path they're going to take. And as you say, war. So in 1585, England is at war with Spain. And so not only are Catholics seen as being disloyal to the Queen in terms of religious policy, but it comes very much more an act of rebellion, you know, that's political, not to go to Protestant church services. So this all gets bound up into this anti-popery, you know, people call them popish.
Yeah.
And it's not just religious, it's political as well, and it becomes a cultural force. I mean, it's one of the most important and deciding factors in the English Civil War in the 17th century, this fear of popery from Europe as well. You know, you think of the Spanish Inquisition earlier, you think of the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day in 1572, when thousands of French Protestants were massacred by the Catholics in Paris and then throughout France. And actually Elizabeth I's spymaster, Francis Walsingham, was there at the time. He was on secondment with the English embassy in Paris at the time. So he was there with his wife, who was pregnant, and with his young daughter. And I think that coloured his vision, this sort of having seen close up what religious fanaticism and religious hatred can do, and the brutality. I mean, babies were dragged across the street and killed, pregnant women were stabbed, people were drowned in the river. I mean, it really was absolutely horrendous. So I think that's what you're dealing with, you know, real sort of jihad type, you know, situation for some people. Yeah. And if you're a head of state, how do you deal with that? You know, how are you fair to Catholics who just want the sacraments?
Yeah.
And who genuinely, sincerely just want to confess their sins and worship freely and nothing else, with the people who, and there were priests and laymen and women who wanted more, who would, you know, ideally have a Catholic head of state, and some of them who would, as you say, get involved in plots and assassination attempts to further that end.
Yeah. I think one thing that I always find with this kind of topic, I mean, everyone loves Elizabeth I. I mean, she, like you said, she's seen as Gloriana, the Virgin Queen. She's always been my favourite monarch, and I think she always will be. But, you know, to see the other side of it that people don't actually see, and I think people get a bit offended by it, you know, when I say that, you know, actually she wasn't a saint, you know, and you look at how many people that she did kill for religious reasons or have executed, you know, and tortured. I mean, it upsets people a little bit. They just go, she can't be like this. She wasn't like this. Surely not. No.
I know. It's very, every now and again, I get something on Twitter and someone just going, you're a despicable person. How dare you think that? Are you programmed to love Bloody Mary? And all, it's very strange. And then on the other side, actually, though, sometimes I get very devoted Catholics who think actually I've been very unfair, and that all they wanted was the sacraments, and that none of them were involved in plots. So it's amazing. In a way, it's absolutely wonderful that it still sort of brings out these strong opinions. But some people, Elizabeth is a hero to many, and she is to me as well at times. You know, I quite often get people sort of say, oh, you're not Team Bess or whatever, which is a sort of weird way of looking at history anyway. But I admire her so much. She was brilliant. She was intelligent. Dealing with men like the Earl of Essex and Leicester, and dealing with these hardline advisors on the other hand, like Walsingham. And she does try and steer this middle way. On the other hand, she is her father's daughter, and she is not afraid to be ruthless. And she certainly knew about the torture. And she had this very strange character called Richard Topcliffe, who was a priest hunter. And they're known as Persevants. So he would be one of these people who would bang on the doors. You know, think of Harvington Hall, just at dawn, he'd be there with the soldiers banging on the door about to do a raid. But he also would, once he had his priest, he would quite often take him home and torture him. He wrote a letter to Elizabeth I saying how he would torture this priest that he captured. And he writes graphically, you know, he explains how he's going to put him in manacles, which are effectively handcuffs, and hang him up by his arms, like a trick at Trenchmore, he says to Elizabeth in this letter. In other words, he's sort of describing a country dance. And it's pretty nasty. And we know that this priest was in fact tortured, and that's exactly what happened to him. So Elizabeth, you know, approved of it effectively. There's a torture warrant from earlier in the reign, which has her signature on it. So she doesn't have deniability.
No. I mean, the other thing, just talking about the priest hunters as well, why do you, I mean, I don't know if you know the answer as such, but I've got my theory. I don't know what you think on this, but Harvington Hall was never searched by priest hunters. Now, Humphrey Packington, the man of the house, was a known recusant. There's documentation that he was fined for it. And all the other houses, I mean, as you know, the Midlands is such a Catholic hotbed. There's lots of things, lots of other houses around nearby with very well-known recusants and Catholic families. Why do you think some houses were searched and some were just left completely well alone? Why have you got any theories of why you think that might be?
It's an excellent question. Firstly, you know, it's quite, just because there's an absence of evidence doesn't mean that it didn't happen. So it might have been searched. We just don't have a record for it. But he was, I think, Packington, especially compared to the Habingtons nearby at Hindlip, was more of an obedient kind of Catholic, if I can put it that way. As you say, yes, he's a recusant. But I think he sort of played the networks a bit better. He wasn't so involved in the Jesuit mission, which was the one that really terrified Elizabethan authorities. And what you do get, I mean, quite often these priest hunters, yes, there are famous names like Topcliffe, but more often than not, it's probably the local JP and a few men. And the way these networks and local power works in the Tudor period, is, you know, they would have been kinsmen, friends, they would have known them. And, you know, Packington would have been quite a big guy on campus. You know what I mean? He would have commanded respect. They also use bribes a lot. So it is, you have these accounts and you sometimes read accounts of raids where quite clearly the priest hunters have gone through the motions and they've searched the house, but they've sort of been paid to look the other way. They don't notice things, or they allow enough time. They make enough noise at the gates to allow the priest to hide. So there are, and also there is, and this is why the recusant mistress is such a powerful figure in this period. There is definitely a squeamishness among some of the officials in breaking into a home where women are sitting there sewing, or they're cooking, and they're, you know, to sort of force a woman to get up and to take him around the house and to break open her chests and her drawers and to look, you know, rummage through everything was something, especially if she's a sort of gentlewoman, is something that they have problems with. And the women were brilliant. They would sort of take advantage of this as well and play on their femininity. So you get, we were talking about Anne Vaux, the Virgin, well, her sister, Eleanor Brooksby, who might well, by the way, have been at Harvington Hall at the time of the gunpowder plot. She sort of disappears when everyone goes to Hindlip, but she might well have been at Harvington. Anyway, she sort of found all this very harrowing, unsurprisingly, so would I. But there's one account of a raid when they come in and her 11-year-old adopted daughter, Frances, is the one who sort of is brave and sort of gets up. And behind her, you have Eleanor sort of sewing and fainting. And you have little Frances going, how dare you, you know, don't come in and storm into the house like this. You know, my mother is in a swoon. Please let me go and get her a drink to refresh her. And they sort of stand there and they're like, oh, terribly sorry. And they stand there and they wait and off she goes and supposedly gets a refreshing cordial for her swooning mother. But what she's really doing is sort of hiding all the priests and making sure that the rosaries and the crucifixes and the altar stones and everything are safely hidden away. So they sort of did that quite a bit. And you get that with Anne Vaux as well, sort of in a different fashion, but she would sort of shout at them and say, how dare you come into my house before the servants are up and the ladies are up and the children are up, you know, what kind of man are you? And so she would sort of harangue them, and with all that noise going on, you know, they could safely hide away the priests. I mean, that's, again, talking of John Gerard earlier, that's one of the fun things about this, is these very personal accounts of what goes on in these raids. And they also give you lovely details, sort of period details about how people actually lived at that time you know, the size of their beds or whatever, and the servants and the equipment they had in their houses.
Yeah, I think John Gerard's autobiography, it gives you there's so much information in there that, you know, if it wasn't for that book, I mean, some of the stuff we just wouldn't, you know, we just wouldn't know. But if you could explain, I mean, something I always mention on my tour, I always mention about Gerard escaping from Braddock's and then eventually being put in the Tower of London.
Yeah.
But he also escapes from there. So if you could just give us a, insight into what actually happens there, because it's the most incredible story. It really is.
It's insane. And you kind of think this can't be true. And yet there are some corroborating sources about it. Yes, he was a bit like a sort of cat with nine lives. He got away with so many raids and escaped so many times, but eventually they caught up with him, and they put him actually first in the Clink prison in London. And that was quite relaxed, and he could get messages out, and he could actually carry on even administering the sacraments to some of the prisoners. But then they tightened up his security, and yep, they took him to the Tower of London. And so he spent his time in the Tower of London in the cell, sort of thinking, how the hell am I going to get out of here? And in the end, he managed to bribe his warder into sending messages out to his friends on the outside. And he would write in these messages, he would write in orange juice, which is an invisible ink. You can write on a blank piece of paper with orange juice. Everyone try it at home. Try it with the kids. It's brilliant. I tried it with mine. And you let the juice dry, and it's invisible. And then if you put a flame or an iron or something to the writing, the heat will bring out the writing. So that's how he got these messages out to his friends. And he also managed to bribe his warder into allowing him to visit another Catholic who was imprisoned in the Tower of London, in the Cradle Tower, which is a bit closer to the river. So in the end, he sort of hatches this plan that if he gets to the roof of this part of the tower, and if he has a rope, then he will be able to get over the moat and off to safety. So he gets this message out to his friends, and soon enough they're rowing up the Thames with a rope in their boat. And they tie one end of it to the wharf, tower wharf, and they chuck the other bit with a weighted stone up to his tower, up to his cell. And he and this other prisoner then tie that end to their tower bit at the top of the roof. And they work their way over the rope, over the moat, and onto safety. And the first guy, Edward Arden, who was related to Shakespeare, by the way, he gets off, he's the first, the rope is taut and it's not so difficult. When it comes to Gerard's turn, and you've got to remember also, he was tortured about 5 months earlier, hung up on the manacles. And again, there's a graphic, horrible description of that. So he is on this rope, it's slack, he's been tortured, and he says at one stage he's just swinging over the moat and he just cannot do it. And he thinks, I've got to let myself go, I've got to land in the moat, I can't do this. And then he said he prayed to God and he got the strength and he carried on. And in the end, he was just so weak that he could hardly make it to the boat, but his friends finally got him onto the boat and then they rowed him off. So yes, he managed to get out. And he, in the end, there's so many priests who got caught and who were hanged, drawn and quartered, but Gerard gets away. And after the gunpowder plot, he got out of England. And that's how we know all his stuff, because he wrote it all up afterwards. But I was just thinking about the Tower of London. I did a very funny, who do you think you are? With an American actor called Josh Duhamel, who was in Transformers and all sorts of things. Anyway, it was great fun because he had this ancestor, and all he knew, he sort of turned up at the Tower of London, all he knew was he had this ancestor called Thomas Norton. And Josh, this actor, is Catholic. And so I think he probably thought that his ancestor was going to be this heroic fellow who was, I don't know what, who was kept in the Tower of London for some reason. And so it was a massive shock to him. And I had to tell him that Thomas Norton, his ancestor, was actually one of the torturers in the Tower. And he was known as Rackmaster Norton. This poor American guy, who I think was sort of quite sort of keen on thinking that his Catholic ancestor was a hero, was in fact a Protestant torturer and one of Elizabeth's key Rackmasters. So that was quite fun. Tower of London was always an interesting place.
It's just amazing. He said, I mean, to be hung by your wrists, I mean, his wrists must have been completely mangled by the time he's, you know, climbing down. It must have been so difficult to...
I know, can you imagine?
It's horrific.
One of the questions I always get asked is, and it's always so hard to answer, but it's sort of the parallels with today. But one of the ones where it's very explicit is the manacles, because if you look at the 2014 torture report about prisoners in places like Abu Ghraib, it actually describes in sort of clinical detail the same torture, sort of being hung up by your wrists, left in stress standing positions, all these kind of euphemisms. Yeah. And that's when you get a real chill in your bones and you kind of think, gosh, yeah, like, yeah, it must have been absolutely horrendous. Yeah.
Finally, I mean, one last, I mean, it's a question that I get asked this quite a lot and I don't really know the answer to it. So hopefully you might have some insight to it. During Elizabeth's reign, how many people are actually, I mean, do we know how many Catholic, I mean, obviously I know everyone's going to admit they're Catholic, but do we have any figures of potentially how many Catholics there are and how many of those are recusants? Have we got any information on that at all?
We've got a bit. It is, as you say, it's really hard because no one's going to put their hand up and say, you know, count me in, I'm a Catholic. no one wants to be persecuted, no one wants to be fined. So we do know who the recusants are because they are the ones who do put their hand up. In 1603, at the end of Elizabeth's reign, there were about 8,500 of them. What is so much harder is to say how many Catholics there were in England, how many church papists. But the closest we can get is, or at least I've found, is the eminent historian John Bossy, late historian now. He said there were about 40,000 Catholics in England. This is in 1603, so yeah, there would have been more earlier. I think that's probably quite conservative, but even so, you know, that's 1%, less than 1% of the population.
Yeah.
Probably more. I mean, certainly in places like Yorkshire and Lancashire, where Catholicism was quite strong still, there would have been more. But we are not talking about a huge amount. I think a lot of people are obedient, you know, as we see in the lockdown now, we're recording during the lockdown, you know, most people do as they're told.
Yeah.
And I think even more so when you have a divine right ruler who knows better than you how to save your soul, I think a lot of people toed the line. And as we were saying earlier, you know, time is the great power that Elizabeth I really has.
Yeah.
She has time, she has the generations, and people get used to it.
Yeah. And I've just got to ask you this because I've never had a chance to ask an author this question and I need to know the answer. God's Traitors is, you can see how in depth it is. I mean, you really know your stuff when you can see how much research has gone into it. How long does it actually take from start to finish to research and actually write a book? How long did that take you?
Oh, well, I take twice as long as anyone else. And it's not because I do more work. I think it's just because I'm slow and I've got children and I'm a very slow writer. But I took, well, my first book came out in, 2008, I think. And God's Traitors came out in 2014. So I'm ashamed to say that was 6 years. I think most people, a book would normally be about 3 years, but and people have different ways of doing it. Some people write their chapters as they go along. I don't. I do all the research or as much as I can do at the beginning. And then I write it all up at the end in one go. Because I kind of think, otherwise, what if you discover something later on that changes, you know, your whole view on all of it? And I love it all. I love the research. I love the manuscripts. There's nothing quite like going to an archive and you know, seeing the paper they wrote on at the time and seeing the smudges or whatever. Doing the Civil War now, there's a manuscript in Hampshire Record Office that I was just looking at recently that has strips of damp on it because it was hidden under floorboards. And it's that kind of stuff. It's so granular, you know, it's thrilling. But I also love the writing, that sort of moment when you sort of have this great compost heap of research and suddenly it all starts to sort of ferment and brew and you can finally put it down and make some sense of it and turn it into a story. I mean, I think, you know, what trade historians, popular historians, as they're called at least, are always trying to do is tell a story and make it as accessible as possible. So the challenge is to get as much research in as possible and to be absolutely on point and up to date with historiography and, you know, get it right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, tell a story and make people turn that page. And that's the challenge and the joy. And yeah, anyone who's listening who wants to do it, there's not much money in it, but it's bloody good fun. I love it. I recommend it.
I have thought about it myself, but I don't think I've got the patience or the intelligence to do it, to be quite honest. But no, thank you, Jessie. Thank you so much for being our guest today. I think everyone will, you know, agree that was very interesting. And it may give people a different insight into what it was actually like during Elizabeth's reign, which is, I think, the biggest thing that we try and get across at Harvington. It's telling that reticent story and that story that you don't always hear, particularly when you're growing up in school. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
Oh, not at all. It was a great pleasure. Lovely to speak to you, Phil.
Thank you, Jessie, and thank you for everyone for listening. Now, if you want to buy Jessie's book, you can find God's Traitors, Terror and Faith in Elizabethan England in places like Waterstones or Amazon. And don't forget, you can follow Harvington Hall on social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram. But until the next time, everybody, stay safe. And from all of us at Harvington Hall, goodbye.